Hey, it's me. It's Bob Saget, right? And this is Bob Saget's Here For You. This is a podcast that I've been doing for over a year and over 100 episodes and really just starting to figure it out. So I hope you're doing good. It's been a crazy world. My friend George Wallace, that was his slogan. I have a great guest today. It's Alan Zweibel. I love Alan Zweibel. If you don't know who Alan Zweibel is, you will, because we're going to have a nice long conversation, because that's what we do. He's a brilliant writer. He was working on the first 5 years of Saturday Night Live from its very inception. He wrote things for Gilda Radner, Roseanne Rosanna Dana, a lot of her stuff, a dear friend of hers, and wrote a book, Bunny Bunny, which became a play. And his love and friendship with her is just, he's a man with compassion and with comedy and with soul. He also wrote the Samurai sketches on Saturday Night Live with John Belushi, just a star comedy man. And he also has done so many films. I love The Story of Us. He has a new film that's coming out. It's been in theaters and now it's going to be online in all of your favorite streamers, and it's called Here Today, and it's starring Billy Crystal and Tiffany Haddish, and it's just a lovely, lovely film, and Billy Crystal directed it. So it's called Here Today, and it should be here today by the time you're listening to this. And I'm also wanting you to know that he did 700 Sundays. He wrote that with Billy Crystal. It's Billy Crystal's amazing Tony-winning show. It is one of the best things I've ever seen, stand-up or otherwise. You want to rate, review, and subscribe. That's nice. I'm trying to sell a can opener in between my intro. And, you know, do that. Subscribe and follow this podcast immediately. Hit the follow button. Or you can download it and keep it forever. Or decide that after you listen to this episode and you want to send it to a relative. So here comes one of the funniest, sweetest people that has graced my life through show business, but also as a friend, Alan Zweibel. Alan, you've been on everything, by the way. A lot of women have filed complaints.
You want to know something? It's something I'm going to have to deal with. Okay. I keep making it a back burner thing, but sooner or later, I'm going to have to deal with it. Yeah.
You look really good, by the way.
As to you, I mean, you're just lucky that there's this screen between us, because every muscle in my body has now been summoned to my hands on my chair over here for me not to leap forward and try to, I think you know what I want to do.
Yeah, and I'm not against it, because I'm happily married. You've been with Robin forever.
Yeah.
And I'm my wife is amazing. Did you meet her, Kelly?
No, I have not, and I can't wait for the four of us to go out and frolic.
Me either. We're going to frolic. We're going to eat chicken fat and Grevenus and vodka.
And then we're going to go, let's say, to some park bench, undo the buckles of our belts, and just try to pass gas for all night.
I thought you were going to say, like, take them out, take out our penises, but instead you just want to pass gas.
Oh no, I went around the corner this time. Well, look, I'm 71 now, so I got to be careful. You know, I got to space out the penis.
That's what I do. If you laid every penis on the earth end to end, you wouldn't smoke. Okay, this is why you're a comedy writer and I just work here.
Where are you geographically? Are you here? Or are you there?
I'm in LA. I'm in my office right now.
Wow, and, well, it's a very nice office. I see the word Believe behind you.
Yeah, that's from Ted Lasso.
Wow.
I'm a fan of the show, so they sent me a bunch of merch.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's a lovely show, don't you agree?
Oh, I really like it. I really like it. I like Hacks. The star, one of the stars of Hacks is Lorraine Newman's daughter.
I know that. I read that. So what's going to happen is, I know you most of my adult life, which started about a month ago, but But you and I have known each other. We've had mutual friends. We always had affection for each other. I'm not just leading the witness, right?
No, no, no. I would agree. If
okay, shoot.
I didn't know I was my turn to talk, but absolutely. And I think I remember when we met each other, as a matter of fact, I think. Brad Gray had a house on, I want to say, Woodruff off of Mulholland, a little house before he moved into those huge...
Woodcliff, I think.
Woodcliff, that's what it was. And Robin and I came over, and you were there, and... Sherry was there.
Yes, my ex-wife, Sherry.
Your ex-wife, Sherry. And I believe that's the first time. If not, maybe you have a recollection of a time before. But I think Gary was basically the link, right?
That was the main... That was... Well, Brad... I was Brad Gray's first client. And then I introduced him to first person I became friends with in Los Angeles, Gary Shandling. And then, yeah, Gary was at that party. And I think, was Mark Gervitz there too? Because that later became Mark's house for a little while. It's a lot of weird stuff because a lot of things happened. A lot of comedic Machiavellian stuff happened.
It's, I think about it often, especially when I was writing this most recent book. So you go back in your memory. Oh, who was in that room? Who was at that party? When did I meet so-and-so? And if with the benefit of retrospect, it's sort of fascinating how we met people, who we met people as a result of it, you know, by way of that person.
Right.
But also what happened, you know, what started out so much fun and so innocent and all of a sudden became complicated.
And I think it became complicated because of feelings of on both sides of betrayal from people, and success does that sometimes. Let's finish this one topic that I went kind of blue on, because we get blue, meaning the old school blue, meaning sad, because we both, you brought it up and you're right. What happened to the purity of the love of, oh, you're a funny person. I'm a funny person. Where are you from? You're from Brooklyn. Oh, really? What was your childhood like? That's what mine was like.
Yeah. Are we brothers? Or are we next door neighbors? Wow, you're the same dented can that I am. You right. know, there's nothing wrong with both of us. Let's be friends. And the excitement of what lied ahead, the adventure of what was in front of us did have a purity to it. And then that excitement waned sometimes earlier, many times later. Like you said, with success, all of a sudden ego came into play. What's business? What kind of business? Wait a second. What if? Why this? Why that?
I thought we were brothers.
Wait a second. Wasn't that supposed to be a word? Was good. What are you saying?
Yeah.
All of those things. And I know it could sound trite, but it really isn't if you've lived through it and have experienced the hurt and the feelings of betrayal from somebody that you love and considered a brother. That came with it. So it was, there is a profound thing that happens. And you and I have spoken about it a lot. You know,
what happened for us once, which meant so much to me, is we hadn't really seen each other in several years. I mean, I saw you briefly in New York, but not really seen each other. And then we ended up on a plane together and we were in first class because, you know, I've never been to Coach. Have you?
I heard that there's seats back there, but I haven't seen them.
Bill Burr has the funniest bit that he started out as I did, as you did, where he was literally like next to the bathroom with a piece of plywood.
All the way back there, sure.
Yeah, the seat where there's a piece of plywood, he would say, between the guy taking a shit while you're sitting there. And that, yes, I couldn't even upgrade forward. I didn't know what was going on. But the truth of it is we talked for the entire, and it was one of those long flights, New York to LA. And we, it was like, oh my God, I just relished every minute with you.
I remember it as well, very with fondness.
And we were dealing with Gary's death and Brad was still alive. Were we, I'm trying to remember, or were they both alive and were we trying to make sense out of what the hell life has been?
I see, my memory is of that. My memory also is me calling you once and saying, boy, Gary really hurt my feelings. And he had sent me either an email or a text or something. And he accused me of lying, my inability to handle the truth properly, however he worded it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew that whatever the issue was, and I can't remember, it was so long ago. The feeling that the hurt that, you mean he thinks that? How could he think that? I would never do that.
Right.
So for him to get to that place to think that and accuse me of it to my face, wow, have we really left each other to a great extent? And I remember calling you, telling you about it, and you talked me down. You talked me down, and you know, look, like you said at the beginning, we've always, and I use this word literally, been attracted to each other. I mean that in every sense of the word.
Me too. I put physical first and then...
Oh, physical, then all the other stuff. Yeah.
Then
yeah.
Comedy, and then as a person, it's nice to talk.
Yeah, it's nice to talk. Yeah, but physical, that's the thing. I felt when I got off the phone with you, I remember saying to my wife, Robin, I said, Bob and I really became friends just now. In a different kind of a way, because you were there for me. You were empathetic. You had had your own issues with Gary. And
I'm still coming to terms with them, and I kind of resolved them near the end of his life. And we were going to see each other, and then he just declined more health-wise. But he had evolved to realize, I think, from what I could tell, because Gary was all about evolving and about betrayal, and his spider senses were always up that someone right. was going to screw him over because he felt so betrayed. And I told him, I have a problem, Gary. Brad Gray and I were friends my whole career. I introduced them. And I also introduced Gary to Harvey Weinstein, who Brad worked for as a runner. So I'm just glad Harvey never did anything to him, because then I would have really been, I would have never been able to make up with Gary. But the love that I will always love Brad, and I will always love Gary. So I said that in Judd Apatow's documentary on Gary, and Judd got it. And so many people love Gary. And I'm part of Brad's family. You know, his kids are my kids, and Jill is my friend, and it's complicated. It's very complicated.
You know, I met Brad through Gary. So Gary was, when I met Gary and we hit it off immediately, we created that show. And it was, you know, shortly afterwards, because Brad managed him, then I met Brad. Always liked Brad. He was always good to me, but I was glad he was on my team, okay? Because I saw how he was elsewhere. I saw there was a Michael Corleone thing there, for lack of a better comparison, whereas Bernie was Vito. And Sandy Wernick was Fredo. Okay,
yeah, so Fredo, the whole family was pretty much why'd they have to put him in the boat? Meanwhile, Sandy's one of the funniest, sweetest guys.
I love Sandy Wernick. He's been, you know, you can go a few years and not speak to Sandy, but you can call him out of the blue and he's there for you. And
100%.
He's a very loyal man.
So let me tell the listeners real quick, just so they have an idea of the people we're talking about. Sandy Wernick, is a manager and an executive at Brillstein Entertainment Partners.
There you go.
It used to be the Brillstein Company, Bernie Brillstein. Bernie Brillstein was old school showbiz, who everybody would know because he was an exec producer of movies like Ghostbusters and I mean, his first client was Norm Crosby. His second client was Jim Henson. So how did you meet Bernie? Because he was like Santa Claus, like a Jewish Santa Claus.
I met him. He used to hang out at SNL. He'd fly in from Los Angeles because Lorne Michaels was his client. And I later learned that Jim Henson was a client. Norm Crosby was his first client. And as SNL grew, so did Bernie. Literally, he was a big man. And he signed Belushi and Aykroyd and Gilda. And I had a decision to make. Back then, there were two big, big time managers. One was Jack Rollins, who was Woody Allen's guy, and Nichols and May and Billy Crystal, David Letterman, Robert Klein. And they were right here in New York. But Bernie was in L.A. And I figured if I wanted to stay in New York, Bernie was the kind of guy who would, I would have a presence in Los Angeles just by virtue of him being there. He always wore a sweatsuit and loved show business. And he would go to one of his kids' Little League games, and he would see the head of a studio there. They'd go for a walk. And then the next day he'd call me up and said, "Alan, I'm getting you a deal with Paramount because I saw so-and-so at the Little League." He was friendly with everybody. He was pals with everybody. And he was old school. He loved show business. As I learned his history as a William Morris agent, I think he represented Elvis Presley.
Yeah, there's pictures of him with Elvis when he was like in the mailroom.
And then Mantle and Maris, he signed to the agency in 1961 when they were hitting all those home runs. And he just loved it. He was, whereas he was the sort of the last of a dying breed. You know, there may be some others who have the same affection for show business.
Well, I would say right now, I guess George Shapiro would be the best example, who's Jerry Seinfeld's manager. He was also an exec producer on Seinfeld, and he handled Andy Kaufman.
And he was related, isn't he a cousin of Carl Reiner?
Nephew of Carl Reiner.
You know, so I think you're absolutely right. You know, there's an affection for talent, creativity, and the show part of show business, okay? Another person who is sort of like that, although he's not a manager, I find George Schlatter,
he's always like, "Saget, let's do something together. Let's bring Laughing back." I'm like, I don't know. And he's old school too.
Well, you know something? Remember years ago, HBO had their annual comedy festival in Aspen.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was there a few years in a row for things that I had that were being produced. But on the way back on the HBO private jet from Aspen to LA, the Aspen airport has a runway, but at the end of the runway are these mountains. So you got to get up pretty quick. Okay. The plane does. So the pilot comes down the aisle, and there's George Schlatter, who is this really big man. And Bernie, who's also this really big man, they're seated next to each other. Okay. So the pilot goes, No. "One of you has to move on the other side of the aisle to eat, you know, to balance out the weight." So one of them moves, and the pilot says to Bernie, "How much do you weigh?" And Bernie says, like, 250. And he says to George, "How much do you weigh?" He says, 255. Then he goes back to Bernie and he goes, "How much do you weigh?" And Bernie says, "I'm not going any higher than 260. Okay. So
it's an auction.
It was an auction and it was fun. And what I felt with a guy like Bernie, and knowing George Schlatter and George Shapiro, that quote unquote old school, there's something paternal about them. You felt you were being taken care of by a parent.
Yep.
A parent who just happened to do a different part of show business than what we do, that they protected us. You know who I've become friendly with is Norman Lear, who's 98.
Me too. He's going to be 99. But I think when people hear this, he might have just had his birthday.
All right. Well, a belated birthday to Norman. You see what I did there? Even though we're doing this before,
But it's right before Shavuos. There's a lot of Lag BaOmer fans out there.
Yeah, no.
I'm down to 0.1% of the population.
No, I'll take you lower. He was a Tisha B'Av baby, wasn't he? But what I find with Norman, I had done in promoting my book, John LaPook, Dr. John LaPook from CBS, he's Norman's son-in-law. So he put us together and we did this podcast, a Zoom, just like this. And I hadn't seen Norman since he hosted SNL the second year of the show. So this was a long time.
And he didn't have, he did something he wasn't supposed to do on the show, which was a bit with his daughter, Kate. And he felt bad about that. And Lauren wasn't happy about it. But of course, that all is water under the bridge now. It was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. But what he did was he danced with her. It was something he wanted to do with his daughter. And that was more important to him than whatever the rules of the show was, which you've got to, as a parent, you've got to admire and applaud that kind of move.
But as a producer, you go like, well, wait a minute. That's not what we do.
Wait a second. That's not the sensibility of this show. This is not where fathers dance.
But I go, and I have ultimate respect for Lauren also. But then I looked at Norman and I go, well, Norman wants to do it. You know, I think more so now Lauren will let the host, if they're a great host and they're great at it, he'll let them run with that. And if they want to hang themselves by thinking that they're the EGOT winner of the world, you know, he'll let them do that too. I think so too.
Look, we're all older now. We've all mellowed to a certain degree. We all have children. I have 5 grandchildren, for God's sake.
How's that possible? Oh, I know how it's possible. I mean,
You have 3 children. One of them has 3. The other one has 2. And the third one, the youngest one is Sari, is engaged.
I'm going to shift gears for a second because I need to talk about you because people, you know, they don't know what the hell's going on because we just started talking. You know, they're like all of a sudden we're into this whole drama that we've both been through with people that we've loved. But you were a comedy joke writer. I'm going all the way back. So you went to school in Buffalo, which is, you know, couldn't you come from normal parents? That was the... But what is it? I'm from Buffalo. That was it. And then that's the punchline, right?
Yes. Go ahead.
But you were... How did you... You wrote for comics. Where did you hang out? At Catch? Rising Star?
Eventually Catch. But when I got out... When I was at the University of Buffalo, I started writing jokes and monologues for Johnny Carson, and Dick Cavett had a show, and Mad Magazine, and sending sketches into Carol Burnett and all of these.
Unsolicited? Variety. You were sending in samples?
Oh, yes. And I have still a pile of rejection slips this thick. Okay, I have it in my closet.
You keep the rejections. I know that. Yeah. I was reading. I read, you're my friend, but here's Wikipedia on you. So it's volumes of stuff. So I went in and took the liberty of changing. Look at that photo.
Oh, yeah. We got to lose that. Yeah. That was about 40 pounds ago. I got to redo this fucking thing. Wow.
You were 22 and you were sending it all the stuff?
22 and I got rejected from 32 law schools that I applied to. So literally. And I then moved back in with my parents and I wanted to be a comedy writer. I didn't know how. And it was very scary because all my college friends were off to law school and med school. And my parents went to Lake Tahoe that summer of 72. Saw Engelbert Humperdinck perform on the... His opening act was a comic named Morty Gunty.
I knew Morty Gunty.
My mother ran into him in a coffee shop the next morning, said, my son wants to be a writer, gave her his phone number and address. Oh. I started writing for him for $7 a joke. And I wrote for him. I wrote for a guy named Freddie Roman.
Of course.
Dick Capri, Dick Lord, Vic Arnell.
Any of those people that are alive or right now at Nate Now's in Beverly Hills? If they're alive. I think Freddie Roman's alive. I saw him.
Freddie Roman and Dick Capri are both alive, well into their 80s.
Right.
And for $7 a joke. And I did that for a couple of years while I was working at a delicatessen. This great living I was making as a comedy writer at $7 a joke. What I did was I said, Jesus, I'm not going to get anywhere with these guys. It used to be the breeding ground for comedians in the decades before, but the hotels were closing down. They were waiting for gambling to come to hopefully resuscitate the area as it had done with Atlantic City. That never happened. So I'm going, all right, just, you know, none of these guys are going to get a show to take me along as a writer. And that's how I would break into TV comedy writing, which had been the formula beforehand. So I looked around, and I said, okay, where's the new breeding ground? Where are the younger comics coming from? There were two clubs in New York, The Improvisation and Catch a Rising Star. Mm-hmm. And that's where David Brenner and our friend Larry David.
Richard Belzer was one of my first hosts at Catch.
Richard Lewis was there all the time. Elaine Boozler. And I went, okay. So my plan was to take all the jokes those old guys wouldn't buy from me, make it into a stand-up comedy act for myself, get on stage, recite the jokes with the hopes that a manager or an agent would come in, say, oh, I like your writing, and you maybe want to represent me. First week that I'm there, I meet a guy who's just starting out also. His name was Billy Crystal. And what he did, he lived about four or five towns over from me on Long Island.
The same Billy Crystal that you wrote 700.
No, this guy owned a granite company, okay?
Totally different guy.
And he...
just a coincidence.
It's an amazing, amazing coincidence. He, B-I-L-L-I-E, okay? This was a woman, okay? Billy lived about four towns over. He was married with a child, and I was still living with my parents. He would pick me up every night in his little blue Volkswagen. We'd go into the city, tell our jokes at Catch a Rising Star, and on the way home, listen to the cassettes and give each other notes on this joke work, maybe you've said this way and all that. And I was there, let's see, about 4 months into this experiment of mine, I was on stage one night, and I was having the hardest time in the world making these six drunks from Des Moines laugh. I get off the stage, I go to the bar, I'm hanging my head, and now I'm waiting for Billy to be done so I can have a ride home. A guy comes in, sits next to me, looks at me, and goes, you know, you're the worst comedian I've ever seen in my life. I said, well, Jesus, thank you. I need, that's really going to help myself because I don't have enough troubles.
That would have been the time for a selfie if they had phones.
If there were selfies.
I want this forever.
You've got to hire a court reporter just to, you know.
Court artist.
Yeah, courtroom artist. So he says, well, your material isn't bad. Did you write it? And I said, yeah. He said, can I see more? That ended up being Lorne Michaels. Lorne was going to all the clubs in New York looking for writers and actors for this new show called Saturday Night Live.
He had moved down from Toronto, or was he visiting?
I think he came in from L.A. See, he started in Toronto. That's where he was born. He had a show called The Lorne and Hart. Hart Pomerantz was his,
right.
You know, they were a team. And then he went to L.A. He wrote Laughing. He did specials for Lily Tomlin.
That's right. Pryor, that's right.
And I think Python. So I ended up, they scheduled a meeting for me and Lorne. He wanted to see more material. I went home to my parents' house on Long Island, stayed up 2 days straight, typed up what I thought were 1,100 of my best jokes, okay? And 2 days later, this was funny. I was so nervous because I never had a meeting, you know, with a producer before. I didn't even know what to wear. I'm going on a young, hip producer, young, hip show. All right, I'll dress young, I'll dress hip. I put on my father's maroon polyester leisure suit, okay?
No, you didn't.
I did. I looked like a big blood clot, you know, sitting on the Long Island Railroad going to the city. And I'm at the hotel lobby. I see a payphone. It's a 75. There's no cell phones. And I go to the payphone. You know, I'm working in a deli. I got these jokes. I this was a big thing. I called Billy Crystal. Billy had had some dinners with Lorne. They had hung out. And he sort of knew the guy. And I said, listen, I'm having a meeting with Lorne. Is there anything you can tell me about him that can give me a leg up in this interview? And he says, well, he's written with Woody Allen and he's produced Monty Python. Oh, and he hates mimes. Lorne hates mimes. So I went, got it.
That's understandable, though.
Yeah, well, I go upstairs and I hand Lorne this tome of 1,100 jokes. He opens the book. He reads the first joke and he goes, very good. And then he closes the book.
That's so great.
I'm up for 2 days straight. To show you how long ago this was, from the reference points, I'd written a joke saying that the post office was about to come out with a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. 10-cent stamp. You want to lick it, it's a quarter. Okay?
Right.
And he said, very good. And he said, I'm sure he showed the book. You know, I'm sure he read everything eventually and showed it to the NBC executives. But it kept me in the room, you know. And he said, how much money do you need to live on? So I said, well, I make $2.75 an hour at the deli. Match it. So he goes,
$7 a joke. I mean, you literally were like the Goodwill of comedy
writers. Oh, God, yeah. I might as well have been outside with one of those kettle drums during Christmas, you know, banging something next to a red thing. So
here's 1,100 jokes. Do you want a hooker joke?
So he says, tell me a little bit more about yourself, which I took to mean that before he committed to this kind of cash, he wanted to see what he was buying. So I said, well, Woody Allen's my idol. Love Monty Python. But if there's one fucking mime on the show, I'm out of here. And he gave me a job. I mean, he laughed and it changed my life. It was.
So you were at the inception. So you were with Michael O'Donohue and Doug. No, not Doug Kenny. He wasn't the writer.
Doug Kenny
was. That was Lampoon.
Yeah, he was on the periphery because of the Lampoon, but the other writers were, let's start with Michael O'Donohue. Chevy was a writer. Lorne was a writer. Al Franken and Tom Davis and I were apprentice writers. Rosie Schuster, Ann Beats, who just passed away a couple of months ago. Mm. Tom Schiller, and, you know, and it was the original cast. It was Belushi and Aykroyd and Gilda, Garrett Morris, Lorraine Newman, Jane Curtin. And then Chevy was doing a Weekend Update. You mentioned
Chevy the original Weekend Update? Was it always was he the head writer?
No, you know something?
Because that's kind of become the tradition has of late become the head writer is the Weekend Update.
Yeah, this was prior to that. The 5 years I was there, there was no designated head writer, okay? I sort of, because joke writing had been my forte before I got there, I gravitated towards Weekend Update because they were jokes, and I eventually produced the segment. There was a man named Herb Sargent who was on staff.
I loved him.
Legendary, legendary man. We were all in our mid-20s. He was in his mid-50s. Mm-hmm. He was that. I learned so much from him, and years later, when I moved to L.A., I would always, when I did its Gary Shandling show, his neighborhood in New York City wasn't wired for Showtime. So I lost a fortune FedExing him Betamax. Okay.
You lost a fortune only in terms of you worked in a deli and jokes were $7.
Well, yeah, that didn't
you
help.
You were still thinking old school Russia.
Old school. You know something, when you have that depression mentality, you never really shake it.
No, you don't. We have to take a quick break. Because, but my breaks are very quick. But I do have to tell you that I don't know if you know this, but I was a deli clerk all through college. For 6 years, I was a deli clerk. So yeah. I didn't know in a supermarket in Cedarbrook Mall in Wincote, Pennsylvania. My dad got me the job because I couldn't get it on my own merit. And I mean, we had a lot in common. And I would do the same stuff, hang out, you know, for 10 years in clubs trying to get people to think I'm funny. And it's just very interesting that the deli clerk thing, and I also saved all of the bad reviews I ever got, which is voluminous. And I actually put them on my wall in my single apartment in Palms in L.A. When I first moved to L.A., you had already been, I think, done with your... No, you were on Saturday Night Live. It was 1978. And so I had all the reviews. It was my wallpaper of things I'd done, letters of rejection from medical schools, you know, pre-med.
Wow. Wow.
Similar stuff. We were forced into this field.
We had no choice.
We had no choice. But I made more money than you as a deli clerk. a lot more. At one point, because I was in the Amalgamated Meat Coaters Union, I would make double and a half time or triple time on a Sunday on a holiday. That could be like $30 an hour. So I just wanted to leave you with that, and we'll be right back.
You're killing me.
I have to ask you now. So you're at the beginning of what is, if not the most, one of the most significant shows ever in American television. Has it gone on 45 years? Is that where we're at?
It's, let's see, first show is October 11th, 1975. So are they going, I think they just completed their 46th year.
Oh my God, I missed the 45th anniversary. So
I wasn't invited either. I was at the 40th.
Right. You, I'm reading stuff that I didn't know. Samurai with John Belushi. How did that come about? And then explain one of your biggest relationships that you'll ever have in your life, barring, of course, your beautiful wife and children, which would be Gilda. But if you could just walk me through, because I don't know about the Samurai stuff and how you got assigned to it. Did you come up with it? Was it John and you at a meeting, at the writer's meeting on a Monday?
John auditioned for the show with that character. So he brought that to the show. The very first Samurai was written by a writer named Tom Schiller.
Right.
He wrote Samurai Hotel. I believe Richard Pryor was in it. Okay. And it was a hit. And that was, I want to say, on the seventh show we ever did. The week of the 11th show, Buck Henry was coming in. All right. And I was so excited because he wrote The Graduate. He co-created Get Smart. He was my favorite guest on The Tonight Show. He would get on and just sit there with Johnny and talk for 8 minutes about nothing. And you would just be laughing your ass off. And Lorne came up to me. He said, look, before you got this job, you worked in a deli, right? I went, yeah. He said, okay, so you write Samurai Deli, Delicatessen. I went, you bet, boss. He walks away. I'm going, what the fuck is that?
I don't know. It's going to be sliced wafer thin.
Okay. So the formula was very simple. And Buck Henry was the perfect stooge for it, because there's a samurai behind a delicatessen counter. Buck walks in and never mentions why is this samurai warrior behind the counter, tells him the kind of sandwich that he wants. And so while John is breaking a loaf of bread on his forehead, you know, and I'm writing, you know, John throws up a tomato, slices it, you know, as it comes down with the sword, Buck never, once again, mentioning, acknowledging who this guy is. The next day was the Super Bowl, okay? So I had Buck say, you know, I'm really looking forward to eating that sandwich during the game tomorrow because I have a lot of money on Pittsburgh, because I think that if Terry Bradshaw just plays a ground game and gives it to Harris, Franco Harris, and he gets it, and then maybe a long bomb every so often to Lynn Swann, and he's just, and Buck wasn't a big football fan, so he had trouble memorizing, but was on the cards, and it worked. It just worked. And then I just wrote the next eight or nine, however many more we did. We did Samurai Night Fever. We did Samurai Taylor, you know. So it was a lot of fun. And the character grew, you know, within the confines of that he couldn't speak English. I remember there was one, I can't remember which samurai it was, but I had Buck say something to the samurai. The samurai didn't believe him, okay? So I wrote in the stage direction, John takes the sword, his small sword, and goes up and down with it three times, okay?
Right. That's the sign of disbelief.
A sign of disbelief. I remember the censor's name was Jay Otley, and there was a meeting. And he says, you can't do that motion. I go, why? He says, because it means masturbation. I went, really? I didn't know them, you know. And then right. The discussion was like, can he just do it once? And I go, well, Jay, if in your life you just do it once and that's enough, that's another story. That's your problem. And all John had to do is, and I think he did it once and it got the laugh that we wanted. Okay. Right. So that was great fun. But once again, you get a talent like John Belushi, you know, he would look at it in the script and he'd look at me and go, all right, I'm gonna save your ass again. Okay. Something like
that. Was that from the get-go? Was that that whole cast? I mean, Bill Murray, took a little bit of time because he actually came onto the show and did that amazing thing where, you know, I haven't been getting a lot of laughs, and I'm going to be honest with you, you know, that whole transparency thing. The new guy. But when it first started, you knew you were in the face of greatness with these performers from the moment it started.
Oh, yeah. I knew it was great. I didn't know that it would be what it would become. I mean, anybody who would tell you, gee, yeah, I knew that 47 years later, we'd still be here, you know, is lying. But you got to understand where I came from. Being a joke writer for Catskill Comics and Tuxedos, who spoke outward to a crowd, I'd never heard of Second City before I got to SNL. Right. I didn't know the Compass Players. I didn't know Groundlings. So when I saw them, Belushi, Aykroyd, Gilda, standing on their feet, creating characters, and also making eye contact with each other and little scenes growing, this was a revelation. This was a new kind of comedy, which I had to adapt to. I did, but it was different than what I was used to. And I knew that nothing I had seen on television was like this. Lorne had always described this from the get-go as the off-Broadway version of television, of variety television.
Well, it was your show of shows, but the off-Broadway version.
You look at the set, it was brick, it was layered, okay. It had, you know, an antique sign, an antique clock, whatever it was. And even wardrobe. I mean, when we were growing up, Bob, if you remember, and even into, you know, the 70s, you look at Carol Burnett or any of the variety shows, the women were wearing Bob Mackie gowns and Tony Orlando was wearing a tuxedo. And we put a Belushi there with his belly hanging out of the bottom of a tie-dye shirt doing right. Joe Cocker, you know? So I knew this was totally, totally different. It was all, Lorne had recruited a bunch of writers and actors who by and large had not been on television before. And his one rule was, hey, let's just make each other laugh. And if we do that, we'll put it on television. He assured us that there was a crowd out there of baby boomers who were not being spoken to comedically. And he was right.
If anybody says there's, you know, no one knows the answer to comedy, I would put him up there as someone that does, because you're saying, let's make ourselves laugh. And also, you know, people go, well, he just throws the wet towels up against the wall to see what sticks. And it's like, well, I don't know how else you find out how genius and ability to show it on camera can be displayed without actually doing it. And so that's what he's done all these years.
And I find his of all the brilliance, what I remember most vividly, it was displayed between dress rehearsal and air, where you would have a dress rehearsal that was tepid, okay? And you go to his office and he starts taking cards down and rearranging and talking, you know, what's in the show, what's not in the show, what does this sketch need? You know, in my day, okay, let's Lorraine can't make the change from this sketch to this sketch. Oh, let's put a commercial parody in between the two. And you're looking at it, and all of a sudden, a show evolves, okay, from something which, like I said, was not that great during dress. And then, wow, how did he do that? You know, and I don't know if that was your experience when you were in the room.
I loved every bit of it. There wasn't anything I didn't. It was one of the most fun things I've ever done.
To see somebody go, all right, you know, without saying, okay, it's my turn. It was his turn. And he would put together something that he would create a diamond, you know, and it's, you know, look how long, look at the people who've come out of there. It just goes on and on and on. And just when you think, well, wait a second, maybe it's run its course. You know, Kristen Wiig comes along, Tina Fey comes along, you know, Cecily Strong comes along. Kate McKinnon could be in any cast in any era, I think, yeah. You know. So it's just astounding.
Now, your closeness with Gilda, you met her at the show?
I met her the first day of the show. I was so nervous seeing all this talent, and I knew that I couldn't, I felt that I couldn't keep up with her, them. In the corner of Lauren's office was a big potted plant. I went behind it. I squatted down and I hid.
Is that true?
Yeah. The biggest day of my life. First meeting as a TV comedy writer. I'm squatting behind the plant and the meeting starts. All of a sudden, I hear from the other side of the tree, can you help me be a parakeet? I parted the leaves and look at it, it's Gilda, and I go, what? And she says, yeah, I think it'd be really funny if I stood on a perch and I scrunched up my face and spoke like a parakeet, but I need a writer to tell me, help me figure out what the parakeet should say. Are you a good parakeet writer? And I'm a great parakeet writer.
Was she being earnest?
She was being very earnest because we eventually did, not on the first show, but she said, why?
A parakeet writer. She was specifically being sincere.
Sincere about it. And I thought there was something so adorable about that phrase. I melted. And she said, why are you hiding behind the plant? You nervous? I said, yeah, a little bit. She says, your first TV show, Alan? And I went, yeah, how do you know my name is Alan? She said, you're the only one wearing a name tag. I was. I had found
it's from the deli. Hello, my name is.
Your service name. And she says, listen, is there any room behind the tree? And I went, yeah. Why? She said, well, it's also my first TV show and I'm nervous. Can I come back there? So I scooched over. She squatted down and that's where we met each other. And we became pals and we made each other laugh. And all I can tell you is that it worked. It worked. It was a platonic love affair that I later wrote about in a book called Bunny Bunny after she passed.
Bunny Bunny is a beautiful, beautiful thing that also became the book and then the play, and then people still do it.
And there's some producers now who are talking about Broadway. I don't know if that will happen, but the candidates to play Gilda were not even born. I don't even know if their parents were born. Okay. You're talking about a long time ago. So, you know, so because of the friendship, and like I said, it was platonic. I didn't want it to be platonic, but she said, you know, she insisted that it be platonic. And, you know, at that age, especially, anytime there's a platonic friendship, I always feel that there's one person who doesn't want it to be platonic. But, okay, all right, if these are the rules, fine, I'll live by them. But one day you'll open your eyes and see the glory that's before you.
So, but you didn't, but once you met Robin, it wasn't like you wanted a thruple.
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, she promoted Robin in my life. Robin worked on the show, and she was Robin's biggest advocate for me as her friend, Gilda. And also I think what it did was it just took me off the scent. So as a matter of fact, years later, her last TV appearance was on its Gary Shandling show. And we thought, and she was nominated for an Emmy for that appearance. And we thought she was in remission, and she wasn't. And when she had gotten sick, I said, what do I do? How do I help? And she said, make me laugh. And that was my role in her life. You know, when we were at SNL, we created Roseanne, Roseanne, and Dana together. We, I was one of the co-creators of Emily Latella, that character that she did. And our friendship, you know, it lasted beyond the show. But we lost touch because she moved to LA eventually, married Gene Wilder. I stayed in New York until I went out to do its Gary Shandling show. And I had rented a house. And, when I went to do the pilot, I would call Gilda figuring, okay, I can resuscitate, because there was no emails back then. And we started losing touch, my platonic friendship with her. And she would always say yes to a date. And then the day before, she would bail. This happened 3-4 times. I called Robin. I said, I don't think Gilda wants to be my platonic friend anymore. And I told her what I just told you. 10 minutes later, Robin calls me and she says, call Gilda. I said, no, I hate her. This is how mature I am. Okay. She says, call her now. I just got off the phone with her. So I call her and I go, what's going on? And she said she had Epstein-Barr virus. And she said, do you know what that is? And I said, yeah, it's like mono, right? And she says, I'm telling you, my bell, my head wants to do everything it's always done. My body just won't let me do it.
Yeah.
I said, what do the doctors say? Well, they say it's definitely Epstein-Barr. It's got to run its course. And she said, when are you coming back out? And I said, well, if this pilot gets sold into a series, I'll be out in 6 weeks to start up the show. So she said, call me. Well, I did. And the day I'm moving into this rented house, all of a sudden, you know, the big burly guys are bringing in the furniture. And I hear Gilda's voice at the front door. And like the welcome wagon, she's standing there with a potted plant. Okay, to bring me as a housewarming gift.
Exactly what you hid behind.
Yeah. And we put it in the corner and I said, boy, you look beautiful. How are you feeling? And she says, so I just found out I don't have Epstein-Barr virus. And I'm going, oh, that's great. We can go to the movies. We can go to, and she says, I have cancer. I went, what? She says, I have ovarian cancer, Swybell. And I need you to help me get through this part of my life. And I said, what do I do? And she said, make me laugh. And that was my role, Bob. You know, I would call her, tell her jokes. Gary and I would do an episode every week. We'd send her the tape, you know, like a Hallmark card. And she became a symbol of, you know, how you can live and have, look this, you know, even with this disease, you know, she appeared on Life magazine. She all sorts of, she used her fame, the publicity for it, about how to deal with it. I remember going to a Laker game with her, this is late 80s, and we're seated courtside, and she's wearing a bandana. And Kareem came up to her, and they didn't know each other, but he points to the bandana, and he goes, don't worry, Gilda. He says, I also have a bald head, but I led the league in scoring last year. Okay, which was so sweet, you know. So ultimately, after she did its Gary Shandling show, and boy, was that momentous. Before she came on, we went for a walk on the beach, and she had cold feet. She said, I don't think that when I come through the door, anyone's going to recognize me or remember me. I haven't been on TV in 6-7 years. And just as I was saying, don't be silly. She says, but you know something? I have to do your show. My comedy is the only weapon I have against this fucker. That's what she called the disease. Okay. Yeah. And she personalized it. She said, can you help me make cancer funny? So Gary and I wrote some cancer jokes with her for her. And when Gary was doing a monologue the night we're taping the show, and then there's a knock at the door, he opens it and it's Gilda. The audience didn't know that she was going to be on. The second they saw her, they erupted in applause. And she did a cancer joke. And it was interesting because you had 300 people. And in a millisecond, there was a slight pause because you don't do cancer jokes. Oh, she has it, so she can. It happened in an instant, and they erupted in laughter. And when I went to edit the show, the angle that I wanted to use, the camera of her entering, I noticed that the frame was jumping just a little bit. I couldn't figure out why. And then I remember the night we shot the show, the cameraman was crying. So when he was holding the stirrups, it was fantastic. And if you ever see it, look for it. It's not really big. It's subtle, but it's there. And then she, I had to make her laugh. That was my role. And when she went to Cedar Sinai, I remember going there to give blood. And I'm on the gurney. A nurse comes, gives me a pad and a pen. I go, what's this for? She says, well, Gilda likes to know whose blood she's getting. Write her a note. She's having a tough time. So I wrote, dear Gilda, I knew I'd get some fluid of mine into you one way or another, which pretty much summed everything up, you know?
So this is one of the closest people in your life that you loved very, very much, and a legend. And people throw that word around, but she was a force in comedy that we... It was reminiscent of Lucy. It had moments of Lily with the characters, but it was... She was so full of love, so I could see how you could fall in love with her.
There was something about her, and it's, you know, people do characters. People are... funny in a way that makes us adore them. But then there's some other people have an intangible quality that comes through the screen where you feel you know that person. So you're not only laughing at a character called Rosanna Dana, who's got funny hair and a dialect, you feel you know Gilda. So it's like a friend of yours who's doing that. So you appreciate it on a couple of levels. Yeah. So you, when that person passes, you feel like you lost a friend that you never met.
And that's the case with a lot of people. I mean, I think people feel that way. There was recently a thing on Twitter, who's the most tragic death that comes to your mind? And a lot of people said Robin Williams. Yeah. And because that's a person that made you laugh so much. And in the acting, like Mrs. Doubtfire and Good Will Hunting, but also to be able to, it's just tragic. I don't, when funny people go, there's something about it, like a star burned out, you know? Whereas if it's a non-funny person, I don't care that much.
You know, if somebody isn't funny, I think their passing is probably for the better.
It's a gift.
It's a gift in its own way. All right, we got rid of one of them. The it's really interesting.
You can still say Yisker.
You can go through the motions fine, put out the platters.
You know? Just lost another 40 people.
We're down to about 11 now, aren't we? I remember when Belushi died. I guess it was my first personal experience with a funny person that I knew who died. And it's interesting because when you look at funny people, especially who do a certain kind of comedy like Belushi did, like Gilda did, they fell down a lot, but they popped up. You know what I mean? You expect them to pop up one way or another. That's the expectation because it can't be that they're lying down and not getting up again. You know, it's what we bring to it as well. It's our experience with them, our expectations. So, yeah. So, and I think that Robin Williams, boy, the tragedy of such a funny guy, and we all knew him going through that private hell to the extent where he did what he did. Dear Lord, I mean, It's not like God came along and, you know, dealt you something. Yeah, in his case, he did have his maladies, but to be so distraught and to be so upset internally, privately, where you do something like that, you go, oh my God, How did I miss that? Oh my God.
And people that knew him well, that were the closest to him, told me that because of the mental illness, that that wasn't him. That was not him that did that. And that's hard to explain to people. And I've had a bunch of mental illness in my family, a sister and other relatives. And it's not, it's hard to explain to people that they say, well, it's got to be part of him. And it's like, no, because Robin wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
He treasured life. That was what he was running from death always. That's what comedians do. It's all survival anyway.
Oh God. Yeah. It's from one audience to another, one film to another. Maybe those people will laugh at me. It's a constant, it's a sprint. You know what I
yeah.
mean? It's, you know, and even from the writing end, you know, which is, you know, it taps into a different thing, but it's always like, gee, I don't know if I can write a joke as good as that again. I don't know if I have any more words left to me. I remember having dinner one night a million years ago with Neil Simon, and he came out in conversation that he wrote so many plays because he was afraid that if he stopped, he wouldn't be able to do it again. You know, I'm just going to ride this wave as long as it takes me, you know.
Okay, here we're back. Okay, so now Saturday Night Live, you're on for 5 years, right?
Yes.
And then what was the thing that sprung you from that? Was it a movie? When was Dragnet written?
Well, you know something? For a few years afterwards, it was a lot of foul tips. I was able to get gigs. I decided to stay in New York, got married to Robin, and I had Bernie Brillstein representing me on the West Coast. So there were a lot of movie scripts that didn't get made. There were a couple of pilots that didn't get made. There was a couple of pilots got made, but didn't get sell into series. So there was about 5 years. I started writing plays that did get put up, that was staged. I wrote my first book.
Right.
And then.
Have you written like what? 8 books, 9 books?
11. The current one is 11.
Oh my
now,
God.
Some of them are co-written. I've written a few with Dave Barry.
Right.
And I've written a few also with Adam Mansbach. If you don't know that name, Adam wrote a children's book a few years ago called Go to Fuck to Sleep, which is one of the funniest books in the world. Because parents of little kids give it to each other because that's how you feel, you know.
The most recent book? I've got everything here and I can't keep track.
Well, it's my cultural memoir. It's called Laugh Lines, My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. And that came out last year. And so that takes you, you know, it's interesting. It starts with me writing for those comics when I'm 21, I'm now 71. So it's 50 years that I've been fortunate enough to be doing what I'm doing. What was the question again?
Leaving Saturday Night Live, you explained how many missed things that didn't happen,
there was
which is show business.
Years. It was some fallow years there. And
but when I met you, when I went to your, I met you already, but I went and looked with my ex-wife because I had to move to New York because I was on a job on CBS that I got fired from. But before I got fired, I needed a place to live. And I came to the place that you and Robin lived in, and it was a two-story, what do they call it? A brownstone thing?
Yeah, it was a brownstone. It was a duplex on the brownstone.
And it had brown shag carpeting that was like 4 inches of shagness. And I was thinking, what happened in this carpeting? Because you said to me, this is where Gilda and Belushi and everybody was in here. And I'm thinking to myself, how cool. And then I thought, ew.
No, okay. Gilda was there a lot. Lorne was there. Franken was there because Robin became a mom the same a few months after Al Franken's wife Franny became a mom. So they used to take the kids in strollers and all of that. Or me and Franken would do it on Sunday mornings. We'd take the kids to a diner on Columbus Avenue. Most of the crew was there that you're talking about when our son Adam when he was circumcised. They were all invited to the bris. So I don't know what they did when I was in another room, but if they, that's where they would have done.
I hope the bris was upstairs, because that shag carpeting, you would have never found the tip. That would have, if it flipped.
We couldn't find the Moyle. Are you kidding?
It was really. That was so thick. Moyle was a very short man.
It was a real short guy. We found him about a week later. He was still trying to climb
out.
Just
for listeners, a moyle is a person that in the Jewish faith cuts the penis and takes off the foreskin. So that place was historic for your life.
It was historic, and it's an interesting thing. When Robin and I, we ultimately moved to L.A., to do the Shanling show. I did a number of movies and a TV series. Ultimately moved back to New York. And when we were going through our stuff, you know, file cabinets, what are we going to take? What are we going to leave? What's junk? She came across a letter, and I have it framed, okay? And it's hanging over there. Why? It was a letter, and at the top were call letters from a local radio station on Long Island, right? And it was dated, I want to say 1983, 84. Dear Mr. Zweibel, thank you so much for being a guest on my high school radio show. Then describes how I came out in the middle of a snowstorm on the Long Island Railroad. Bob, as I sit here, I don't remember this. Okay. And then it thanks me for recommending him and his show to, and he mentions Michael O'Donoghue and mentions Gilda as potential guests.
Right.
And he concludes by saying, if I ever make it, I'm never going to forget your kindness. Sincerely yours. And 15-year-old scrawl is Judd Apatow, okay? Wow. And the reason I bring it up is Judd, if you speak to him, he came to that apartment, and I'm going, gee, I don't remember. But he describes every picture on the wall that I did indeed have, mm-hmm. and all the stuff. So, in fact, he was there. But my policy always was, you know, so many people, as you know, are nice to us, you know, and you got to pay it forward, you know.
Absolutely.
It's the only thing I request of anybody who asks a favor, a young kid. I said, you bet. I said, the only thing I want in return is that when you make it and you're at a space where you can help somebody, when a kid calls you, I want you to act as nice to him as I'm trying to be to you. And
unfortunately, you're hooking people up with their stalker now.
Yeah. You know something? I mean,
you're very lucky that Judd is Judd and didn't turn out to be one of those weirdos.
I should have been. Yeah, I shouldn't have been as gracious. Okay,
with that one kid.
With that one, you know, I should have maybe cast a little smaller net.
Anybody that writes to me, I'm going to help.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're capable of exhaling, here's my home number. Yeah.
Now, you wrote a lot of movies and you're a really great writer. And you know what I love is The Story of Us.
The Story of Us was, boy, you know, given what we do, it's always what I was, and I'm sure it's the same with you, Bob. You remember the process. Was it fun to do? Right. Was it fun to go to the set? Oh, well, we met so-and-so. That's when we became friends. Oh, that's when we shared that house and the whatever. The Story of Us, I was riding with Rob Reiner in a car one day out in L.A., and Robin and I, though we never separated, we were going through a rough patch. And I said,
was that because of me? Was it when I visited?
It's when you visited the apartment so many years before.
That's what I'm saying.
Still not able to shake it off. It was still a thing. It was still a thing. And I said to Rob, I said, you know, if Robin and I would ever separate, I think we should do it at the beginning of summer, as soon as the kids leave for sleepaway camp. This way there'll be 2 months where we can figure things out and they won't be affected by it, but because they won't be in the house. And Rob said, what about visiting day? I said, well, we would have to put on a little bit of an act, like where everything is still cool. And he said, why don't we do that script? And I started writing it. And what I wanted in it as initially as the sole writer of it, I didn't want there to be a black hat and a white hat. I didn't want a good guy and a bad guy. I didn't want a seminal thing to happen like an affair. I just wanted to do the wear and tear of the job of being in a long-term marriage. Okay. And ultimately it's the story of us. Can a marriage survive 15 years of marriage? Okay. But every draft I wrote, the guy was the greatest. The woman was a bitch. And it was so lopsided. It was totally what it wasn't supposed to be. Then we went to...
You were not in therapy at this time, right?
Oh, no. This is way before. This what drove me to therapy.
Absolutely.
We went to Larry David. There was a 50th birthday dinner for him in a restaurant in L.A. And a lot of people were seated around this table. And I didn't know who Jessie Nelson was. She has since, you know, she's this wonderful writer and director. Right now, she's got, she wrote the book for the Broadway show Waitress, okay? But she had done Corinna. And she's seated across the table from me with her wife, with her husband, Brian Gordon. And I don't know them, but I see that he says something to her and she looks at him and goes, huh? Well, and it was the same exact expression that I saw Robin always give me when I would suggest something. I go, wow. So on the way out, I introduced myself. I said, listen, we don't know each other, but would you like to spill your guts about your marriage in front of millions of people with me? We ended up writing together. We kept what I wrote that was any good. Nothing was sacred. And we wrote together. So she brought her marriage to it. When Rob Reiner said, I want to direct that, he brought his marriage to it. Mm-hmm. And we had a great time doing that movie.
It's a really lovely movie, and people should see it. It's Michelle Pfeiffer and Bruce Willis.
Yeah, you know, and to this day, my wife, Robin, says, Michelle Pfeiffer played me.
And Bruce Willis played you. So, I mean, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could save people from a burning building.
Yeah. Remember me in the Nakatomi building? You know.
So one of the best things I ever saw in my life done by anybody who has ever approached stand up and my was 700 Sundays. So, and I saw it several times, and that, I guess you would tell me, was a work in progress, because it would change throughout its run and incarnations, right?
Well, yes and no. Yes. What happened was I was writing the story of
us.
Just
do the yes part so I look like I'm smart.
You know something, Bob? That's the best observation that anyone, you know, are you sure your last name is not Curie? Seriously.
Thank you. I'm creating vaccines as we speak.
I was writing the story of us with Jessie Nelson in an office I had at Castle Rock Productions out in L.A. And I shared a suite with Larry David and Billy Crystal under the auspices of Rob Reiner, who was a owner of the company. Rob hosted the third Saturday Night Live ever. He ended up directing Story of Us. He and I are doing a pilot right now. So, I mean, these relationships, as we at the very beginning, are longstanding, and they're based on friendships. And, you know, we just happen to do the same thing. And, wow, let's hang out some more.
Yeah.
Billy stuck his head in. We had never worked with each other, you know, since the days that we were giving each other notes in the Volkswagen to and from Catch a Rising Star. He said, can I have you for a second? And I went out. He said, I'm thinking of doing a one-man Broadway show called 700 Sundays. For those six listeners that are left, the reason it's called that is Billy's father worked 6 days a week, number of jobs to support the family. We only had Sundays off. That was he and his father's day to go to a ball game, the beach, whatever. And his father died suddenly when he was 15 years old. So Billy calculated that he had roughly 700 Sundays with his father, hence the title. He said, would you like to collaborate with me on this? I said, you bet. And it was, to this day, you know, it's up there in terms of process. Yes, it was very successful. But what we did was Billy had 4 or 5 pages of anecdotes. And Des Makanoff, who directed it, who ran the La Jolla Playhouse at the time, mm-hmm. Billy, Des Makanoff, myself, and a script person would go to a black box theater.
Right.
I think up at Pepperdine. And then we moved to the Geffen Theater, the black box there. And Billy would get up and start telling these anecdotes. And I would take down notes and whatever. And I talked to Billy about it. And we just started expanding and expanding and expanding. And ultimately, there was a script. And we took it to the La Jolla Playhouse that Des ran. And they have 3 theaters there. The biggest one is 500 seats. And the critics know not to come because they know it's all works in progress. They have a program called From the Page to the Stage. And Bob, it was exciting as hell because it was like doing live TV again, because Billy would do a show. Then we would go for pizza afterwards and discuss what worked, what didn't. The next morning, I'd wake up early. I'd go to the business center in the hotel. I type new jokes, new dialogues, new roads to go, bring it to rehearsal. He'd look it over. If whatever he liked, he incorporated into the rehearsal. Whatever he felt comfortable saying, he did it in the show that night. And 500 people told you whether or not you did a good job that morning. And so we went, I think it was either 12 or 14 shows. And by the end of it, you know, the rule that we had to remind Billy of, and he's fully aware of it. God, is he smart. He had monologues that he had been doing for years. And we said, this is a play. So if we can make a routine that you have contextual, somehow work it into your family, your upbringing, of course, we'll tailor it to be in here, embedded. But unless you're father fought Muhammad Ali, I'm sorry, I don't know how that piece fits right. in. Okay.
Because right. someone Ali.
Okay. And ultimately, we had a script and came to New York, workshopped it. And this is the part I love. You know, we're in this building on 42nd Street. I think it was called the Duke, if I'm not mistaken. We're, let's say, on the 5th floor. On the 7th floor is Mike Nichols and Eric Idle. They're in rehearsal for Spamalot.
Right.
Oh, God. You know, so when you get a community like that and you're in the Sandlot with other people, you know, it's the greatest. And after so many years, what I felt honored about was here was my buddy. He trusted me with his family. He's on stage talking about them. I'm sitting back here. So I see it on the wide shot. And like I said, Billy is one of the smartest people in the world.
Yeah.
But still, I was a second set of eyes. And you know, I'd have to say, and this is just an example. You know, I think we can use a joke at your father's funeral. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He trusted me with his family, putting words into the mouths of people I never met. The process was my friend trusting me earning more and more of that trust. And we're both very, very fond of that effort. And we didn't work again together until here today, which is the movie we just...
Which I wanted to watch. For some reason, I thought it was streaming, but it's still in...
It starts streaming July 20th, which is next week.
That is exactly what I wanted to hear, because yeah. I've been wanting to see it. And I watched the trailer 10 times, and it looks just incredibly low. It's what you are, and it's what Billy is. And I know Billy directed it, and you wrote it with him, right?
Exactly right.
What you have that I look up to so much, what I aspire to be, what I, at 65, I hope to one day. But I love when you have compassion and pure heart and then find the humor in it. And that's where all things great come from.
I appreciate that. That means the world to me, Bob. And it's really interesting. We mentioned Shandling before. I think that, first of all, I think that that's where I live. I think that's where my instincts are. But I also remember Gary saying, right from the core, okay, get your story down, get your people down. And the jokes come later. You build your Christmas tree and then you hang the ornaments, you know. Mm-hmm. And with Here Today, that was born out of an anecdote, something I told as a guest on the Letterman show one night. I was the prize in a silent auction. Whoever bid the highest got to have lunch with me. All right. So for some charity in New York, I live in New Jersey. So the big day comes where the one who won the silent auction gets to have lunch with me. I get in the car, I go through the tunnel, I pay for parking, and I meet this young lady in a restaurant. And during the course of our discussion, I said, listen, I don't want to be indelicate, but how much did you pay? Because I'm used to like Larry David, they'll pay $100,000 to watch him brush his teeth, right?
Right.
And so she goes, 22. I go, $2,200. It's not Larry David money, but she goes, no, $22. That's how much it costs.
You're back at your roots.
Yeah, I'm going, wow. I said, really? $22? She said, yeah, it started at 20 and it went up at 50 cent increments. So now I hate her.
Okay. Well, it's also the value of the human body.
Yeah. Melt me down and maybe you'll get to about that much. And she ordered a seafood salad bigger than my high school. And she's jumbo shrimp and with the oysters and clams. And as we're talking, I noticed that her left ear is turning a little red. And then lips are a little bigger. And now the lips are like perpendicular to the table. And she's having a reaction to the seafood. And I'm saying to myself, how long is my obligation to this person?
I think it takes her all the way to Lenox Hill.
I took her all the way to Lenox Hill. I got an ambulance, went with her there.
Did you really?
Yeah, literally. Literally. I took her to Lenox Hill, exactly the hospital.
How did I do that? I didn't know where were you eating? What streets?
We were eating on...
Only a Jew can tell you.
An ambulance. We were on the west side, but in the west 70s, so we just went right through the park. Okay.
I remember my heart attack. I was having a steak. I don't like broccolini, but I had the baked potato. That's my ancestor's memory of every tragedy. So what happened? What happened? They got her on a Benadryl drip or gave her cortisone?
All I know is she had, that they did, but she had no insurance. I bought her an EpiPen. So what cost her $22 cost me like $1,100, all right? So I'm telling this on the Letterman show as a guest. Billy sees it and texts me. He said, let that be the first scene in a May-December relationship between an older guy and a younger woman. And let's see where it goes. That was the genesis of it. And we wrote this script and we knew that it needed to be more than just old guy, young woman. We've seen that. Unfortunately, at that time, my dad was had the onset of dementia. Billy had an aunt, same thing. So we both knew Herb Sargent, okay, from SNL, who we mentioned before, somebody we venerated. Herb didn't have dementia, but we wanted Billy to play that kind of a guy, a senior writer, a voice of reason on a Saturday Night Live daily show kind of show. But in our case over here, he was starting to get the onset of dementia. Herb didn't have that, but we brought that to the character. And we had the character was writing a book, which was an elegy, an ode to his deceased wife. He was struggling with it, and he wanted to finish it before he lost his words entirely. Billy meets Tiffany Haddish, who played the younger woman. A friendship ensued, and once she sees what the situation is, she becomes a muse. And it's so really funny, but really heartfelt as well. And once again, it ran the gamut of the same kind of emotions that you mentioned, 700 Sundays. And Billy was brilliant as an actor in it, as a director, obviously when we were co-writing it. But, you know, writing it with the director is a different kind of writing, because he would tell me how he envisions a scene. So it was a couple of steps ahead of the game. Oh, so I would write to that vision, you know. So it was a great asset.
And what a gift to be able to work again with your lifelong friend, that you've already accomplished something that very few people have accomplished. I have to tell you a quick story. So I went to 700 Sundays 4 times, just because it was in LA and New York. And I was doing a play in New York at one point, so I was there too. And that is an amazing community to get to be part of.
It's like, four streets that becomes your entire world.
And thank God it's coming back, because, you know, like the West End and in London, when at 8 o'clock, this magic happens all at the same time.
Yeah.
Or 7 o'clock for some of these shows that are longer. I don't know why they changed it.
Well, it's like Shabbat in Jerusalem all of a sudden.
The old people can't stay up anyway, past Thursday. But what happened was, I took my mom and dad to see the show in LA. And because 700 Sundays had all of the photographs in it, and the screen is full with history of, like you say, the photographs are switched. It's the same families switched photographs, or you got my pictures. And it's his whole history. He talks about, you know, Babe Ruth, there's Babe Ruth. You know, you talk about everybody. I mean, his whole family. So my dad is particularly touched by this. He was a Depression baby, youngster. And he goes backstage, and my dad was a very sweet, emotional man, and also had a very sick sense of humor. That's how he dealt with death. Hence, here I am. So we're there. My dad hugs Billy a little too long. I'm not kidding. A little too long, because he was happy. It wasn't a physical thing, because my mom likes Billy also. They're both gone. So I'm like Anthony Perkins in Psycho. I like Billy very much. So they both hug him. They both love him, all of his work. My mother thinks he's very handsome. That's all she cared about. They walk out ahead of me to go back. Billy takes me aside and whispers in my ear, "Your father touched my penis." Because he knew what would make me laugh. I mean,
well...
And I could not leave the room for a moment. I had to compose myself.
No, you talk about, you know, Billy knows how to read a room.
Okay. Oh, hell yeah. Go ahead.
No, that was it. I was going to break into the song, so you better go.
So I know you have a life, and you're also working on another thing that you can't talk about yet, right?
I'm working on another thing with Billy. It's too premature to talk about. I'm co-writing a script with Barry Levinson, which is an education. Right. And I'm doing a, hopefully they're going to produce it. I wrote a pilot. Barry Sonnenfeld, the great director, wrote a memoir called Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. And it's hilarious. Rob Reiner's company, they're with Warner Brothers. They bought it, optioned it, hired me to adapt it. And Jason Alexander would play the lead. So they're going to go out starting next week or the week after and see if somebody wants to buy it, you know.
Well, because I'm running out of anything intelligent, I just want to know the date again on Here Today so people can see it online.
July 20th.
July 20th. Everybody needs to watch this movie because it was smartly in theaters. It's one of the first things that came back only in theaters. And I know that was delivered when it came out in May.
It's really interesting, Bob. It was in theaters, and opening night, my family came, and I bought out a theater at a mall, a movie complex here in New Jersey, and the theater had 58 seats in it, but you were only able, because of social distancing, sell 22 seats. So on my phone, I have a picture above of the sign above the concession stand where it goes, "Here Today, sold out." Okay, it's 22 seats. So yeah, it did get a little bit of a running start on it. I know it's closing the Edinburgh Film Festival.
Yeah.
Which is in Scotland for you folks. And yeah, I'd love to, once you see it, let me know what you think. I'm dying for you to see it.
I will. Because this Zoom, we're just going to keep it open. So if you just keep it open for till the 20th, on the 21st, I'll talk to you.
Well, what I'll do is I'm going to plug this in because I've been going on the battery and I see that the little line thing is going like that.
Are you really not plugged in? Are you on the battery?
I'm on the battery, but I'll plug it in and I'll revive the
whole thing. Did you do that purposely so eventually the cyst would die of its own natural causes?
No. What I was going to do, yeah, it's like a respirator. What I was going to do at one point is go, Bob, give me a second. I got to get my plug because I hear but we're not up to that because it's not red yet. So we're fine.
And we've talked for a long time. This is really... I could talk to you a lot. I really want to see you. So
I want to see you too. What, do you have any plans to come this way?
I do. And I'll let you know. Well, please give my love to Robin and the 47 grandchildren in your shtetl.
Will your lovely bride come to New York with you?
Absolutely. She always does. And you will maybe want to have more than a platonic relationship with her. And I won't allow it. I just won't.
Well, I'm telling you right now, I'm frustrated.
Okay, it's fine. She's okay with it, you just have some stuff to sign.
You know something? I'm going to bring, when the four of us get together, if it's okay with you, a notary public okay, to dinner with us.
They were taken out with DocuSign. They're done.
We can do that too, yeah. Yeah, that's really fun, isn't it? You write your name and all of a sudden, yeah.
You know it's crooked. You know that someone's using your name. I mean,
of course, they can take it and put it on anything, couldn't they?
I think this podcast is already released just by the fact that we're on Zoom. Zoom is the thief. I'm going to be doing a movie with Zoom. I'm really excited about it.
A Zoom movie, huh?
Yeah, that's the Zoom movie. Look how well that sat.
God almighty.
Well, I love you, and thank you for being my guest.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for being my friend. And I know I've heard this from many men before, but I'm going to say it to you also. Call me when you get to the city. Okay.
That's the great Alan Zweibel. Alan Zweibel, I don't know what to tell you. He is... he's a writing, I don't use the word legend a lot. Maybe it's because I don't talk to many of them. I do, though, I think. But Alan Zweibel is one of the funniest, and I think you know from having just listened to this, one of the sweetest people that's in comedy. And he's just a brilliant writer and such a big heart, and that's why his work always reflects that. So what you want to do is July 20th, you want to see Here Today, which he wrote with Billy Crystal, and it stars Billy Crystal and Tiffany Haddish, and Billy directed it, and it's just a very charming movie that I'm looking forward to seeing. So that's Alan Zweibel. That is a comedy legend from the onset of Saturday Night Live, and you got to hear all that. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got through it. You might have needed a Yiddish dictionary. I don't know if that's something that people are using right now. I would venture to say not. Thank you for joining me for this episode. This, of course, is Bob Saget's Here For You. It's not Here For You. That's a separate podcast. That's someone else's. This is Bob Saget's Here For You, because that's my name. And when I say it, I cringe at my own name. I have self-loathing over my name because I didn't pick it. It just happened. They wanted me to be Robert Saget, but my middle name is Lane, so it could have been Bobby Lane, and then I just would have done game shows. But I've tried that. But Bobby Lane, it would have lasted longer. So I'm wishing you guys well. I really am. I'm hoping you guys are all doing good and hanging in there and coming back to comedy. I'm on tour right now. Just go to bobsaget.com and you can check all my dates. I'll be going everywhere and I'll be doing a special and I'll let you know when I'm doing that. And then I'm just doing all new stuff and working my ass off and loving the hell out of it. I have no ass to begin with. It's incredibly flat. It's just like it's like a pizza with a hole in it. I'm sorry. I got too relaxed after talking to Alan. You rate, review, you subscribe. That's what you do to this podcast. And, you can download it and you can follow it. Subscribe and follow. That's always good. And you can rate and review. Thanks again to Alan Zweibel. And thank all of you. All the best, everybody.